You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
This Grand Canyon Lost City is definitely very fascinating. What else can you tell us about it? You know, dive right into it. I mean,
well,
do we know any more about it?
It is very close, according to my friend Jack Andrews. It's very close to where the Hopi have this Tsipapuni, the emergence from the underworld. Okay,
mm-hmm.
It's actually. A geological formation. It's called a travertine dome in the bottom, a big limestone kind of a dome in the bottom of the Grand Canyon. And it's sort of by where the Little Colorado River meets the major part of the Colorado River in Grand Canyon. And this cave is supposed to be located very close to this Tsipapuni of the Hopi, which is, you know, a very sacred area for the Hopi. And it's also a very dangerous place to go because there were experienced hikers washed away a few years ago. A number of hikers got caught in a flash flood and they were just washed away. So you know it's kind of a dangerous place to go poking around. So
yeah.
Not many people go down there.
And if you went to look for it, is there anything like in the Grand Canyon that's like, you know, sealed off from people where you can't go and explore, or is it something that you could actually go look for?
Well, there's a theory that the Smithsonian simply didn't want to reveal this information and just sealed off the entrance to the cave and just you know, you can't find it anymore. And it's hard to get to because it's very high up on the cliff apparently,
mm-hmm.
You know there's rumors of a cover up by the Smithsonian, so they didn't want this. You know, there's like a statue. There's a statue of a kind of looks like Buddha in a lotus position inside the cave, and there are these mummies that they found, and there was a dining hall with the utensils, and you know it's just this. The article, the original article that you can find the newspaper accounts of, it's just amazing artifacts that were found in this cave in the Grand Canyon, and you know the Smithsonian were not about to to get into this kind of diffusionistic. Concept. They wanted to keep you know Native Americans on this continent and no interaction between other cultures in ancient times. They wanted to toe the line in that regard.
Yeah, maintain the status quo.
Right. Yeah.
And how did this story even come out in the first place? You alluded to there was just an article somewhere, and then what happened? Then no one ever. There was no follow up or anything, and they were like, "What are you talking about?" That kind of thing.
Well, yeah, there was this expedition described in this newspaper article in great detail, and you can find it on the internet. Just Lost City of the Grand Canyon. You can Google that and find the article. There's you know, Ancient American Magazine has done articles on this particular cave in the Grand Canyon.
And do the Hopi, I presume they know about it. You said sort of near where they go to ascend or descend to the underworld. Are they like, yeah, that's this place that we know of? Or are they sort of like, you know, don't want to talk about it? Or have they said anything about this lost city?
Well, more or less, from my information, that I haven't been able to find out anything specific from the Hopi about this particular cave. They're just not talking about it because it is such a sacred area. And they don't want a lot of people going down there trying to find this place, in other words, because it is a ritualistic area that they go to every year, and that they don't want a lot of non-Indians trying to invade the place.
Yeah.
The Hopi are very circumspect, and they're very polite and courteous, but they're not very forthcoming in the information that they divulge. Some Hopis now are thinking that it is a time to divulge this information. It is the end of the fourth world, and a lot of the ceremonies that the Hopi are doing are becoming not as strong as they used to be. They're performing fewer and fewer of the sacred ceremonies every year, and the traditional culture is being eroded by, you know, the contemporary life. A lot of Native Americans are leaving the reservation and finding jobs in cities because there's really no economic growth in, at least on the Hopi and the surrounding Navajo reservation. They don't have casinos or anything like this that a lot of the tribes have. So, you know, just the pressures of modern day life is causing the Hopi to leave the reservation and leave the ceremonial life. So, a Hopi friend of mine said that he expects that the Hopi ceremonial cycle will probably be dead in about 50 years and or maybe sooner than that.
Wow.
So, and you know, it doesn't look too good. You know, once the Hopi stop performing their ceremonies, there's a theory that the earth will be thrown out of balance because they're not performing these ceremonies anymore.
Yeah.
And all the earth changes and so forth kind of point to the fact that the earth is out of balance. And the Hopi are trying desperately to live by the old ways and retain their ancient language. But fewer and fewer Hopis are learning the old, you know, the ancient Hopi language. And it's getting harder and harder to carry on the ceremonial life.
Yeah. Now, what about the Egyptian connection sort of here with their Orion correlation? Seems like you said, the Hopi connection to the Orion is even stronger than the Egyptian, but it does lend credence to some kind of, they were on the same page of some kind. We're not sure exactly how. What are your thoughts on that? What's going on there? How did that come about?
Well, I think that there's a global Orion legacy that you can find Orion correlations all over the world. Since I started to do the research on this book, and it took me about 7 years to write this book, but I found other Orion correlations all over the world. There's one, for instance, at Teotihuacan in Mexico. There's one near Milan in Italy. A colleague of mine, Jeff Nisbet, found one in Scotland, an Orion correlation in Scotland.
Wow.
Another colleague of mine, Rob Milne, is doing excellent work in South Africa, finding a lot of Orion correlations down there with petroglyphs and so forth. So there's, you know, Graham Hancock in his book Fingerprints of the Gods kind of suggested this. That there might be a global Orion legacy passed down from an ancient civilization. That might be the root of, you know, why these Orion correlations are popping up all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, he made the observation that the on the Nazca Plains in Peru, there's a great spider that's supposed to represent the constellation Orion. And he at that point in the book, he said that this perhaps signals some kind of global cult in ancient times dealing with Orion.
Yeah, that's kind of where the next question I have for you is going to go, is that of these sort of different scenarios, this is speculative, of course, which do you think is most likely, a global culture, or do you think each of these small cultures were influenced by the same gods? Or maybe just that, almost kind of like a combination of the two, where the original small, like the very first people on Earth, were influenced by gods, and then that sort of spread throughout the world. Hence the Orion correlation. Those seem to be three different possible scenarios. Which do you think is the most likely?
Well, I believe that in terms of the Hopi, they were directed by this one god Masau, which may have had a physical presence at one time among the people, that it's not just an interdimensional spirit. In fact, the Kachinas, which I mentioned before, they say now that the Kachinas just come in spirit because the Hopi and mankind in general is so corrupt. But in ancient times, the Kachinas came as physical beings and interacted with the Hopi people as physical beings. So I think that there might have been, early on in ancient times, there might have been a physical interaction between the people, which they perceived as gods, and these creatures, these entities, whatever you want to call them.
This whole discussion really kind of dances around the big esoteric field that's sort of been growing in the last 50 years or whatever, and that is the ancient astronauts sort of idea. But in the book, you really you sort of imply that, but you don't really dive right in. It's not, you know, I wouldn't say, like, if I was telling somebody about the book, which I am, I guess, because we are doing a radio show. I wouldn't say the book isn't an ancient astronauts book, really. It's more an astroarchaeology book. But you seem to endorse kind of the idea of the ancient astronauts. So what do you think, I guess, is the question I have for you.
I try to go by the evidence that I have. I'm not going to make wild claims about ancient astronauts. I do have a picture, for instance, of what I think to be of a flying shield. And there are myths. I should mention that this is a petroglyph of a triangular flying shield in the book, and there are stories and legends about, you know, flying shields in Hopi culture, and you just kind of wonder, where is this coming from? For instance, there's a story that's a nice story that I like to relate. It's a story about there was a great flood, which I mentioned before. It concluded the Third World. This great flood that was engulfing this village, and everybody ran out of the village, and brother and sister, they were twins, they somehow got left behind. So they tried to find out where the parents had gone from, because the flood was about to engulf the village. So they started out, and they met up with this creature that came from a flying shield. Okay, mm-hmm. this creature came down, and they call it the sky god. Soktuknang is the term for the sky god, and the god this god had a costume which sort of looked like they described it as looking like icicles, you know, clothing that looked like icicles. Hmm. You know, for a non-technological society, this might be the way to describe a metallic sort of clothing or something.
Yeah.
But this god took the two children up in this flying shield, and they were above the landscape, and this god was a benevolent god. He treated the children with melons and corn, and fed the children, and he said that he would return. This god would return in their dreams to instruct them about the ways to lead a good life. And then the god brought them down just outside where the parents had fled. And so the children were deposited there, and they could be rejoined with the parents. So this is a myth or a legend that the Hopi have about these flying shields, and about this particular god that helped these children out. So you wonder what to do with this kind of material. You know, you see pictures of flying shields and petroglyphs, and you hear stories about them. I just kind of bring that up. I don't try to make any assertions, the von Däniken theory and so forth. I don't go that far, but I do just present the information and evidence as I see it, and I let the readers make up their own mind about whether this is extraterrestrial influence or not.
And actually, I'll salute you for that because I didn't want it to come off the wrong way the earlier way I phrased it. But I think that's a good thing the way you frame the book because you provide the evidence that you know someone else could come up with a really flimsy book, but base it entirely around the ancient astronaut UFO gimmick, if you will. And they wouldn't have the wealth of material that you have in your book, which really provides a lot of evidence for the ancient astronaut idea. So I appreciate that.
Well, it's just a beginning. I'm doing another book right now and continuing on the research in the same vein. And hopefully I'll come up with some more definitive thoughts and theories about this. But this is just an initial kind of exploration of the material and the Orion correlation theory, basically. I wanted to bring that out in the book.
And that's always sort of like a sticky situation in and of itself anyway. I mean, I would presume that the Hopis, they're not down with the idea that their gods were actually ETs. But are there any people in the Hopi community that are like, you know what, yeah, we kind of, in this modern day and age, we've kind of come to the realization that maybe the people that were coming here were ETs and not you know, that they just didn't know how to say it in the way back then.
Well, I think that there is a very strong tradition of star elders and influence from the skies. That's part of the Hopi culture, and it's not seen as something foreign. It's just part of their cosmology, and they're used to thinking in terms of sky gods and star elders and so forth. So it's not out of the realm of possibility. It's just the way that we interpret it today is as being these ETs. But as I said, you know, Masao, there's evidence that, you know, he looks, there's a picture of it in my book. Masao looks very much like an extraterrestrial gray. And the root word, mas, it means gray. So there must be something to that.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like actually that they'd be more open to, you know, if the ETs were to come down here and tell us that, you know, that they were the gods of lore throughout all the ancient religions, they'd probably, sounds like the Hopis and some of the Native Americans would probably be more open to that idea than you know, more mainstream religions.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And we sort of touched here on the Hopi prophecies, but let's sort of dig into that now, because there's always, there's a lot of talk about Hopi prophecies nowadays. It seems like everybody seems to think we're living in the end times, and as you said, the Hopis seem to think so as well. What gives them that idea that we're at the end of the fourth world, and what does that forebode for us?
Well, the elders have prophesied a lot of these earth changes that are coming about. They foretold the coming of telegraph lines, for instance. They call them spider webs, metaphorically, across the land. Telephone lines or that. The elders foretold people driving on black ribbons with horseless carriages on black ribbons. You know, this was before automobiles came about, you know, and, yeah. But they foretold these things. And they also talked about a gourd of ashes falling on the land. This was, you know, the atomic explosions at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They talked about the time when women will take on men's dress, so forth, and you know, with the women's liberation movement and so forth. So you know, they talked about a lot of these things that are coming to pass, and a lot of the earth changes that are now happening. They already foretold that would happen. They basically say that in the very end times, a figure called Pahana will return. Pahana is kind of like the Maya Kukulkan or the Aztec Quetzalcoatl, that figure of serpent the plumed serpent, mm-hmm. that was here and then went away. Pahana was here in the beginning with Masaru and the other figures, and then what happened? He took a piece of a stone tablet. He took a corner of a stone tablet, the Fire Clan tablet, specifically, and took a piece of this, and he said, at the end times, I'll return with this piece and match it up with the tablets you have. So you'll know me by the fact that I have this piece that matches up with this the rest of the tablet. He's supposed to have a kind of a red cap or a red hat, and he'll come with two helpers. The one helper will carry a Maltese cross and a swastika, and the second helper will carry a sun symbol. The Maltese cross, you can find Maltese crosses in petroglyphs across the American Southwest. You can also find swastikas in this rock art in the Southwest. So these are not Germanic, specifically Germanic symbols. They're Native American symbols that have been used for many years by the Hopi people.
Now you said he took a corner off the tablet. Is the original tablet that he took the corner off? Is that around anywhere? So we can, if he shows up with the corner.
Well, it's being kept by the Bear Clan, keeper of this particular tablet. So they it's on the Hopi reservation somewhere, being kept in secret. So when Pahana returns, then and shows this corner of the tablet, then that means that the end time will come, and the purifier will come from the west, and it'll be bad times.
Yeah, and so it's in existence. It's not on display or anything.
Yeah. So, in fact, there's an author named Frank Waters. He wrote a kind of a classic book called Book of the Hopi. He publishes what these Bear Clan tablets looked like.
Mm-hmm.
There was also another anthropologist. Really, only two non-Indians have seen these tablets, so they're kept in secret more or less, and they're not casually shown to the world.
I'm surprised they'd survive so long. You would just think that sort of thing would get lost, sort of like the Holy Spear or something like that,
Well, it's a very sacred artifact, and it's kind of like the original sacred pipe of Lakota Sioux. It's still being kept in secret, and it's just a ritual artifact from ancient times, and it'd be very very disastrous for it to just disappear.
Yeah, but you know how it is with war and that sort of thing, especially with the encroachment of the white man and all that sort of thing. You'd think that would be the kind of thing that would have gotten lost in the shuffle. But it's good to hear that it's still in existence.
Oh, yeah.
What makes them of the opinion, though, that we're at the end of the fourth? Like, what is there any specific sign that they have designated that now they know for sure that we're, or those are the sort of things that you said, like the black ribbons and what earth changes are? Are they lay it out in like a chronological order type of thing? Where now are we supposed to be looking for anything on the horizon here that would correspond with Hopi prophecy?
Well, they've said constantly that there will be famine, floods, earthquakes, just disastrous kind of changes that we see taking place right now. Again, there's no specific time frame involved. The Maya say 2012. Well, that may or may not come to pass. But the Hopi, they're just saying, well, it'll come very soon. They're not saying exactly when.
Well, yeah.
It's rather up in the air right now. Like I say, the ceremonies are becoming less vibrant all the time on the reservation. And there are fewer and fewer people doing these ceremonies. So this is another sign that, when the people don't learn the language, when they're not doing the ceremonies anymore, then the fourth world will come to an end.
And from the descriptions in the book of how the endings of the other worlds, it sounds like that's sort of what happened in those worlds too,
There is some hope for the next life. The people are supposed to come through this these hard times and then go into a better world where the people will eventually reassert themselves as spiritual people.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully we'll make it through, you and I, and you allude to you're doing some other work here. What's next on the horizon for you? Obviously, you're doing a lot of radio shows and stuff to talk about the Orion Zone and doing some extensive other research. What do you have on your plate for the future?
Well, I'm working on another book about this material, extending the material and trying to find definitely, you know, whether there's some extraterrestrial intervention or not, to be more specific about that. But it's basically an extension of what I've started in the Orion Zone.
And what about any speaking engagements or anything like that you wanna mention or plug?
Well, you can go to my website, theorionzone.com, and find out a lot of information. There are a lot of essays on the website. There are there's a section of rock art that you can check out, and there's a lot of maps, like I say, on the website, so you can get a better idea of what the book is about by checking these out. And you can also order the book, theorionzone.com, or adventuresunlimitedpress.com, either place.
There you go.
And order the book.
Well, Gary, thank you very much for coming on the show. Like I said, The Orion Zone is the book. It's very thorough. It's just rich with detail. And definitely makes me want to go out to Arizona and check out some of these landmarks and stuff like that. Definitely a trip I want to make in the future now, having read the book.
Just give me a call, Tim. We'll take you out there.
Definitely. It sounds like it would be quite an adventure. The book is, of course, like I just said, The Orion Zone. You can find it at AdventuresUnlimitedPress.com. And, of course, you can find out tons of information. I'm glad Gary mentioned this because the OrionZone.com website is just an amazing hub of information that you can find from the book. That is just you just dive in there. You'll be in there for days, hours at least, checking out the OrionZone.com. That's the website. Gary, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Tim. Appreciate it.
There you have it, folks. That does it for this week's edition of Banal America Audio. Big, big thanks to Gary A. David for coming on the show. Of course, you can find out more information on him at theorionzone.com, www.theorionzone.com. Moving right along now, we're going to skip over the listener feedback portion of the show, and instead I'll give you, the listeners, a little feedback of my own. For starters, I want to thank all of the great people who wrote to me over the past 2 or 3 weeks here, not just after my father had died, but for that period when he was in the hospital and slowly dying. I just got so many emails. A lot of you I haven't even written back yet. It's just hard to rehash that sort of thing, but I wanted to thank you all from the bottom of my heart. I really appreciate it. This has been an emotionally, spiritually, physically exhausting experience. Tomorrow, June 4th, it'll have been a month since we brought my dad into the hospital. We actually brought him in on the 4th of May, and he was comatose from about the 6th up until the day he died on the 19th. So this has been a long process, and as many of you know, he was a victim of cancer, and he was fighting the disease for 2.5 years, and it was a struggle, it really was. And for the last 8 months, I've been here full-time pretty much, helping him out and taking care of him with my mom. So it's been a difficult situation here in the aftermath of his passing. I feel empty, like there's a hole here, and I'm not really sure what to make of that. I feel a little lost. I'm thankful that we have the audio show, that I have been all of America.com, because that at least can keep my mind off of things for a little while. And so that's pretty good. And I'm doing all right. I mean, as I've noted to a lot of people, that my father's health really went downhill starting in January. That's when things really, really started to take a turn for the worse. And he was really deteriorating pretty rapidly from there. And so, as much as I wish he was still here, and as much as I miss him tremendously, I'm happy that he's not in pain anymore, because he was in constant pain, and I'm happy that he's in a better place, and I know I'm going to see him again, so it's all good. It's really difficult for me. I never really opened up here on the program about my personal life here at home. Most, if not all, of the listeners, aside from some of the long-time Banal of America readers, had no idea that my father was sick, so I'm sure it came as quite a surprise to you. But I was ready for this, and as ready as you can be, I guess, is the expression. And so we're gonna persevere. We're gonna move on. We're gonna keep going here. I'm not just gonna shut down the radio show because my dad died. I wouldn't do that to the listeners here. We have a plan, and that is to get through the month of June, and then that'll do it for season two, and then we're going to move on to season three. We're going to stay the course here, so you don't have to worry about that. My dad was a great guy, folks. If you go to banalofamerica.com, there's a little in memoriam tag in the left-hand side of the screen, and if you click that, the obituary is there, and you can find out more about him. He was just a great guy, and his influence and fingerprints are all over banalofamerica.com, not just in the name of the website, but in my writing style, my sense of humor, my honesty. That comes from my dad, and he played a part in Banal of America, whether he realized it or not, and his influence is felt every day, I think, at the website. I could ramble on here for a while, but I'm going to just say thanks again to everybody who wrote in with your condolences and your prayers and your thoughts. It was hugely appreciated and just really had an effect on me. Thank you so much again from the bottom of my heart, and my family thanks you too. Of course, I want to thank the great staff of banalofamerica.com, Leslie, Chiron, R. Lee, Joe V., and Tina Senna. These folks are awesome, and they're like family to me. They stuck with me through this more than I ever could have expected of them. So I appreciate that so much. It's not just about the paranormal here. We're a team, and when one of us is hurting, the rest of the crew is hurting too. So I appreciate that, and I appreciate their outpouring of support during this really difficult time. They've assured me they're not going anywhere. I'm not going anywhere. But AllAmerica.com is going to continue. You don't have to worry about that. We've weathered the storm here as best we could, and now I think it's time to, you know, sail into some more peaceful waters, if you will. So check out banalofamerica.com every day with new columns, updates, satire, all kinds of stuff. There's something new at banalofamerica.com every day, and most of the time that's the result of the fine work of the staff of BOA, Leslie, Chiron, R. Lee, Joe V., and Tina Senna. Huge thanks to them for everything. If you're a long-time Banal of America audio listener or an appreciative newcomer and you want to help support the audio series and the website, now, more than ever, your support is needed. Suffice it to say, I am wading in a lot of serious responsibilities now that my father has passed away, and money will definitely become an issue in the not-too-distant future. So whatever you can do to help support the audio series and the website will help stave off that impending financial crisis that we're trying to avoid. How can you do that? You go to banalofamerica.com, you click the PayPal button, and you make a donation. No donation is too small, and all the donations are going to go towards paying for banalofamerica.com and BOA Audio. Next week on the program, we're going to have Chris Stiles, the principal investigator of the Shag Harbor incident. October 4th, 1967, a UFO touched down into the Shag Harbor. Chris Stiles saw it. He was just a little boy at the time. 25 years later, he decided to investigate the Shag Harbor incident, and he's pretty much the guy who put the Shag Harbor case on the map of ufology. We're going to dig all into this tremendously strong UFO case, why Chris decided to resurrect the Shag Harbor incident, and how he went about digging into this UFO case. We're going to go in-depth on just tons of details on the case. The skeptical Father Gaffney, testimony of the divers who searched for the UFO, what people thought the UFO was, and how that was contrasted by the government's interpretation of events, how Shag Harbor changed UFO history in Canada, and just tons and tons more. This is a very richly detailed edition of Banal of America Audio. I taped the interview yesterday, so it's quite fresh as well, and that's going to be Chris Stiles on Banal of America Audio next week to talk about the Shag Harbor incident. And on that note, we close out a tremendously depressing edition of Banal of America Audio, and hopefully the mood will be a little bit brighter next week, with the exception maybe of the last episode that I did when my dad was very sick and the writing was on the wall as far as his impending death. With the exception of that episode, this may be one of the toughest episodes I've ever had to put together. And hopefully you didn't mind that I bared my soul here for you a little bit. We'll survive, folks. We're going to be all right. Until you hear from me next week, this is Tim Banal, signing off.